Chapter 4. She greeted her guests in a lime green hostess costume with long belled sleeves and pants. Her shoes were comfortable and reflected her hope for the evening. The first to arrive was the celebrity psychic Mary Jo Perrin, who came with Robert, her teenage son, and the last was pink-faced Father Dyer. He was young and diminutive, with mischievous eyes behind steel-rimmed spectacles. At the door, he apologized for his lateness. I couldn't find the right necktie, he told Chris expressionlessly. She stared at him blankly, then burst into laughter. Her day-long depression began to lift. The drinks did their work. By 9:45, all were scattered about the living room, eating their dinners in vibrant knots of conversation. Chris filled her plate from the steaming buffet and scanned the room for Mrs. Perrin. Ah, there, on a sofa with Father Wagner, the Jesuit dean. Chris had spoken to him briefly. He had a bald, freckled scalp and a dry, soft manner. Chris drifted to the sofa and folded to the floor in front of the coffee table as the psychic chuckled with mirth. Oh, come on, Mary Jo, the dean said, smiling, as he lifted a forkful of curry to his mouth. Yeah, come on, echoed Chris. Oh, hi! Great curry, said the dean. Not too hot, Father? No, not at all. It's just right. Mary Jo has been telling me there used to be a Jesuit who was also a medium. And he doesn't believe me, said the psychic with mirth. Ah, distinguo, corrected the dean. I just said it was hard to believe. You mean medium? Asked Chris. Why, of course, said Mary Jo. He even used to levitate. Oh, I do that every morning, said the Jesuit quietly. You mean he held seances? Chris asked Mrs. Perrin. Well, yes, she answered. He was very, very famous in the 19th century. In fact, he was probably the only spiritualist of his time who wasn't ever convicted of fraud. As I said, he wasn't a Jesuit, commented the dean. Oh my, but was he ever? The psychic laughed. When he turned 22, he joined the Jesuits and promised not to work any more as a medium, but they threw him out of France, she laughed even harder, right after a seance that he held at the Tuileries. You know what he did? In the middle of the seance, he told the Empress she was about to be touched by the hands of a spirit child who was about to fully materialize, and when they certainly turned all the lights on, they caught him sitting with his naked foot on the Empress's arm. Can you imagine? The Jesuit was smiling as he set down his plate. Don't come looking for discounts anymore on indulgences, Mary Jo. Oh, come on, Father. Every family's got one black sheep. We were pushing our quota with the Medici popes, he replied. You know, I had an experience once, Chris began. But the dean interrupted. Are you making this a matter of confession? Chris smiled and said, No, I'm not a Catholic. Oh, well, neither are the Jesuits, Perrin teased with a smile. Dominican slander, retorted the dean. Then to Chris he said, I'm sorry, my dear. You were saying? Well, just that I thought I saw somebody levitate once in Bhutan. She recounted the story. Do you think that's possible? She ended. I mean, really? Who knows, replied the Jesuit dean. He shrugged. Who knows what gravity is, or matter when it comes to that? Would you like my opinion? Interjected Mrs. Perrin. No, Mary Jo, the dean told her. I've taken a vow of poverty. So have I, Chris muttered.
What was that? Asked the dean, leaning forward.
Oh, nothing. Say, there's something I've been meaning to ask you. Do you know that little cottage that's back of the church over there? She pointed in the general direction.
Oh, Holy Trinity?
Yeah, right. Well, what goes on there?
Oh, well, that's where they say Black Mass, said Mrs. Perrin.
Black who?
Black Mass.
Black Mass, what's that?
Come on, she's kidding, said the dean.
Yes, I know, said Chris, but I'm dumb. I mean, what's a Black Mass?
Oh, well, basically, it's a travesty on the Catholic Mass, explained the dean. It's connected to devil worship.
Good grief. I mean, there really is such a thing?
I really couldn't say.
Although I heard a statistic once about something like maybe 50,000 black masses being said every year in the city of Paris.
You mean now, marveled Chris?
It's just something I heard.
Yes, of course, from the Jesuits' secret service, twittered Mrs. Perrin.
Not at all, said the dean. My voices told me.
The women laughed.
You know, back in L.A., mentioned Chris, hear an awful lot of stories about witch cults being around. I've often wondered if it's true.
Well, as I said, I wouldn't know, said the dean. But I'll tell you who might, Joe Dyer. Where's Joe?
The dean looked around.
Oh, there he is, over there.
He nodded toward the other priest, who was standing at the buffet with his back to them, heaping a second helping onto his plate.
Hey, Joe?
The young priest turned, his face impassive. You called, great dean?
The dean beckoned with his fingers.
Just a second, answered Dyer, turning back to resume his attack on the curry and salad.
That's the only leprechaun in the priesthood, said the dean with fondness.
He sipped at his wine. They had a couple of cases of desecration in Holy Trinity Church last week, and Joe said something about one of them reminding him of some of the things they used to do at Black Mass, so I expect he knows something about the subject.
Oh, what happened to the church? Asked Mary Jo Perrin.
Oh, it's really too disgusting, said the dean. Come on, we're all through with our dinners. No, please, it's too much, he demurred.
Oh, come on.
You mean you can't read my mind, Mary Jo? The dean asked her.
Oh, I could, she responded, smiling, but I really don't think that I'm worthy to enter that holy of holies.
Well, it really is sick, said the dean.
He described the desecrations. In the first of the incidents, the elderly sacristan of the church had discovered a mound of human excrement on the altar cloth directly before the tabernacle.
Oh, that really is sick, Mrs. Perrin grimaced.
Well, the other one's even worse, the dean remarked, then employed indirection and one or two euphemisms to explain how a massive phallus sculpted in clay had been found glued firmly to a statue of Christ on the left side altar.
Sick enough, he concluded.
Chris noticed that the psychic seemed genuinely disturbed as she said,
Oh, that's enough now. I'm sorry that I asked. Let's change the subject.
No, I'm fascinated, said Chris.
Yes, of course. I'm a fascinating human, came a voice.
It was Father Dyer. A heaping plate of food held up in one hand, he was hovering over Chris as he solemnly intoned,
Listen, give me just a minute, and then I'll be back. I think I've got something going over there with the astronaut.
Like what? Asked the dean.
Dyer eyed him expressionlessly from behind his glasses as he answered, First missionary on the moon?
All but Dyer burst into laughter. His comedic technique
relied on deadpan delivery.
Well, you're just the right size, said Mrs. Perrin. They could stow you away in the nose cone.
No, not me, the young priest corrected her solemnly. I've been trying to fix it up for Emery, he said to the dean in an aside,
then turned back to the women to explain, That's our dean of discipline on campus. Nobody's up there, and that's what he likes. He likes things quiet.
Still deadpan, Dyer glanced across the room at the astronaut.
Excuse me, he said, and walked away. Mrs. Perrin looked after him. I like him, she said.
Me too, Chris agreed.
Then she turned to the dean.
You haven't told me what goes on in that cottage, she reminded him.
Is it a big secret?
Who's that priest I keep seeing there? You know, sort of dark, looks like a boxer. You know the one I mean?
The dean nodded, lowering his head.
Father Karras, he said, in a lowered tone and with a trace of regret. He put down his wine glass and turned it by the stem.
Had a pretty rough knock last night, poor guy.
A what? Chris asked.
Well, his mother passed away.
Chris felt a mysterious sensation of grief that she couldn't explain.
Oh, I'm so sorry, she said softly.
He seems to be taking it pretty hard, resumed the Jesuit. Seems she was living by herself and
I guess she was dead for several days before they found her. Oh, how awful, Mrs. Perrin murmured. Who found her? Chris asked, slightly frowning.
Superintendent for apartment building. I'm guessing they wouldn't have found her even now, except, well, the next-door neighbors complained about a radio going all the time.
Oh, that's so sad, Chris said quietly.
Excuse me, please, madam.
Chris looked up at Carl. He was holding a serving tray bearing liqueurs and slender cordial glasses.
Sure, set it down here, Carl. That'll be fine.
Chris always served liqueurs to her guests herself. It added an intimacy, she felt, that might otherwise be lacking.
Well, let's see now. I'll start with you, she said to the dean and Mrs. Perrin. She served them, then she moved about the room, taking orders and fetching for each of her guests. And by the time she had made the rounds, the various clusters had shifted to new combinations, except for Dyer and the astronaut, who seemed to be getting thicker.
No, I'm really not a priest, Chris heard Dyer say solemnly, his arm on the astronaut's chuckle-heaved shoulder. I'm actually a terribly avant-garde rabbi.
Chris was standing with Ellen Cleary, reminiscing about Moscow, when she heard a familiar, strident voice ringing angrily through from the kitchen.
Oh, Jesus, Burke!
He was shrieking obscenities at someone. Chris excused herself and went quickly to the kitchen, where Dennings was railing viciously at Carl, while Sharon made futile attempts to hush him.
Burke, exclaimed Chris, knock it off!
The director ignored her and continued to rage, the corners of his mouth flecked foamy with saliva, while Carl leaned mutely against the seat with folded arms and stolid expression, his eyes fixed unwaveringly on Dennings.
Carl, Chris snapped, would you get out of here? Get out! Can't you see how he is?
But the Swiss would not budge until Chris began shoving him toward the door.
Nazi pig! Dennings shouted at Carl's back,
then turned genially to Chris and rubbing his hands together asked, now then, what's for dessert?
Dessert?
Chris thumped her brow with the heel of her hand. Well, I'm hungry, Dennings petulantly whined. Chris turned to Sharon and said, feed him. I've got to get Reagan up to bed. And for Christ's sakes, Burke, you freaking behave yourself. There are priests out there.
Dennings creased his brow as his eyes grew intense with a sudden and seemingly genuine interest.
Oh, you noticed that, too, he asked without guile.
Chris tilted her head up, breathed out, I'm done, and strode out of the kitchen. She went down to check on Reagan in the basement playroom, where her daughter had spent the entire day, and discovered her playing with a Ouija board. Reagan seemed sullen, abstracted, remote. Well, at least she isn't feisty, Chris reflected. And hopeful of diverting her, she brought Reagan up to the living room and began introducing her to the guests.
Oh, isn't she darling? Said the wife of the senator.
Reagan was unusually well-behaved, except with Mrs. Perrin, refusing to speak to her or shake her hand. But the psychic made a joke of it.
Knows I'm a fake, she said, smiling and winking at Chris.
But then, with a curious air of scrutiny, she reached forward and gripped Reagan's hand with a gentle pressure, as if checking her pulse. Reagan quickly shook her off and glared malevolently. Oh, dear, she must be very tired, Mrs. Perrin said casually. Yet she continued to stare at Reagan with a probing fixity and anxiety she couldn't explain. She's been feeling kind of sick, Chris murmured an apology. She looked down at Reagan. Haven't you, honey? Reagan did not answer. She kept her eyes on the floor. There was no one left for Reagan to meet except the senator and Robert, Mrs. Perrin's son, and Chris thought it best to pass them up. She took Reagan up to bed and tucked her in.
Do you think you can sleep? Chris asked.
I don't know, Reagan answered dreamily. She turned on her side
and was staring at the wall with a distant expression. Do you like me to read to you for a while?
A shake of the head.
Okay then, honey. Try to sleep. Chris leaned over and kissed her, and then walked to the door and flicked the light switch. Night, my baby. Chris was almost out the door when Reagan called out to her very softly. Mother, what's wrong with me? So haunted, the tone so despairing and disproportionate to her condition. For a moment, Chris felt shaken and confused, but quickly she righted herself. Well, it's just like I said, Rags, it's nerves. All you need is those pills for a couple of weeks. I know you'll be feeling fine, just fine, honey. Now then, try to go to sleep, hon, okay?
No response.
Chris waited. Okay, she repeated.
Okay.
Chris abruptly noticed goose pimples rising on her forearm. She rubbed at them, looking around.
Jesus, Jesus, it gets cold in this room. Where's that draft coming from?
She moved to the window and checked along the edges. Found nothing. Turned to Reagan. You warm enough, baby?
No answer.
Chris moved to the bedside.
Hey, you asleep?
Eyes closed, deep breathing. Chris tiptoed from the room. From the hall, she heard singing, and as she walked down the stairs, she saw with pleasure that the young Father Dyer was playing the piano near the living room picture window and was leading a group that had gathered around him in cheerful song. As she entered the living room, they had just finished singing Till We Meet Again. Chris started forward to join the group, but was quickly intercepted by the senator and his wife, who had their coats across their arms and looked edgy. Oh, you're leaving so soon? Chris asked.
Oh, I'm really so sorry, my dear. We've had a marvelous evening, the senator refused. But poor Martha's got a headache.
Oh, I am so sorry. I do feel terrible, moaned the senator's wife. Will you excuse us, Chris? It's been such a lovely party. I'm really sorry you have to go, Chris told them. As she accompanied the couple to the door, Chris could hear Father Dyer in the background asking, Does anyone else know the words to I'll bet you're sorry, Tokyo Rose?
On her way to the living room,
Sharon stepped quietly out from the study. Hey, where's Burke? Chris asked her.
In there, Sharon answered, with a nod toward the study.
He's sleeping it off. Say, what did the senator say to you? Anything? No, they just left.
Oh, good, just as well.
Just as well?
What do you mean, Sharon? What's harpooning?
Ah, well, Burke, Sharon sighed. In a guarded tone, she described an encounter between the senator and Dennings, who had remarked to him in passing that there appeared to be an alien pubic hair floating round in my gin. Then he turned to the senator's wife and added in a vaguely accusatory tone, Never seen it before in my life. Have you?
Chris gasped and giggled and rolled her eyes as Sharon went on to describe how the senator's embarrassed reaction had triggered one of Denning's chaotic rages, in which he'd expressed his boundless gratitude for the existence of politicians, since without them to compare to, one couldn't easily distinguish who the statesmen were, you see. And when the senator had moved away in an icy huff, the director had turned to Sharon and said proudly, There, you see? I didn't curse. Don't you agree that I handled the situation demurely?
Chris couldn't help laughing.
Oh, well, let him sleep. But you'd better stay in there in case he wakes up, he said.
Would you mind? No, of course not.
In the living room, Mary Jo Perrin sat alone in a corner chair. She looked preoccupied and troubled. Chris started to join her, but changed her mind and headed for Dyer on the piano instead. Dyer broke off his playing of chords and looked up to greet her.
Yes, young lady, he said, and so what can we offer you today? As it happens, we're running a special on novenas.
Chris chuckled with the others gathered round.
Well, I thought I'd get the scoop on what goes on at Black Mass, she said. Father Wagner said you were the expert.
The group at the piano fell silent with interest.
No, not really, said Dyer, lightly touching some chords again.
Why do you mention Black Mass?
Oh, well, some of us were talking before about, well, about those things they found at the church, at Holy Trinity.
Oh, you mean the desecrations, Dyer interrupted.
The astronaut broke in. Hey, someone want to let us in on what you're talking about here? I'm lost.
Me too, said Edlin Cleary. Dyer lifted his hands from the piano and looked up at them.
Well, they found some desecrations at the church down the street, he explained.
Well, like what? Asked the astronaut.
Forget it, Father Dyer advised them. Let's just say some obscenities and leave it at that.
Father Wagner says you told him it was like a black mass, prompted Chris. So I wonder what went on at those things.
Well, look, I really don't know all that much, said Dyer. In fact, most of what I know is what I've heard from another Jeb on campus.
Oh, what's a Jeb? Chris asked.
Oh, that's short for Jesuit.
Father Karras, he's our expert on all this sort of stuff.
Chris was suddenly alert.
Oh, the dark-complexioned priest at Holy Trinity?
Oh, you know him, Dyer asked her.
No, I just heard him mention, that's all.
Well, I think he did a paper on it once, said Dyer.
You know, just from the psychiatric side.
What do you mean? Asked Chris.
What do you mean? What do you mean?
You're telling me he's a psychiatrist?
Oh, well, sure.
Oh, gee, I'm sorry. I just assumed that you knew, said Dyer.
Listen, somebody tell me something, the astronaut demanded good-naturedly. What does go on at Black Mass?
Dyer shrugged. Let's just say perversions, obscenities, blasphemies. It's an evil parody of the Catholic Mass, where instead of God, they worshipped Satan and sometimes offered human sacrifice.
Ellen Cleary smiled thinly, shook her head, and walked away.
This is getting much too creepy for me, she said.
Chris paid her no notice. But how can you know that? She asked the young Jesuit.
I mean, even if there was such a thing as Black Mass, who's to say what went on there?
Well, said Dyer, I guess they got most of it from the people who were caught and then confessed.
Oh, come on, interjected the dean.
He had just joined the group unobtrusively.
Those confessions were worthless, Joe. They were tortured.
No, only the snotty ones, Dyer said blandly. There was a ripple of vaguely nervous laughter. The dean eyed his watch.
Well, I really should be going, he said to Chris. I've got the 6 o'clock mass in Dahlgren Chapel tomorrow.
I've got the banjo mass, Dyer beamed.
Then his eyes showed shock as they shifted to a point in the room behind Chris, and abruptly he sobered.
Well, now, I think we have a visitor, Mrs. McNeil, he cautioned, motioning with his head.
Chris turned and gasped on seeing Reagan in her nightgown, urinating gushingly onto the rug, as staring up fixedly at the astronaut, she intoned with dead eyes and in a lifeless voice, "You're going to die up there."
Oh, my baby, Chris cried as she rushed with her arms out to her daughter. Oh, Rags, honey, come, sweetheart, come on, let's go upstairs.
She'd taken Reagan by the hand, and as she led her away, she looked over her shoulder at the ashen astronaut.
Oh, I'm so sorry, Chris apologized tremulously. She's been sick. She must be walking in her sleep. She didn't know what she was saying.
Gee, maybe we should go, she heard Dyer say to someone.
No, no, stay, Chris called back. It's okay, I'll be back in a minute.
Chris paused at the open door by the kitchen, instructing Willie to see to the rug before the stain became indelible. Then walked Reagan upstairs to her bathroom, bathed her, and changed her nightgown.
Honey, why did you say that? Chris asked her repeatedly.
But Reagan appeared not to understand, and with her eyes staring vacantly, mumbled soft strings of words without meaning. Chris tucked her into bed, and almost immediately, Reagan appeared to fall asleep. Chris waited, listening to her breathing for a time, and then quietly left the room. At the bottom of the stairs, she encountered Sharon and the young director of the second unit, assisting Dennings out of the study. They had called a cab and were going to shepherd him back to his suite at the Georgetown Inn. "Take it easy," Chris advised, as they left the house with Dennings between them, and one of his arms draped over each of their shoulders. Barely conscious, the director murmured, "Fuck it," and then slipped into the fog and the waiting cab. Chris returned to the living room, where the guests who still remained expressed their sympathy as she gave them a brief account of Reagan's illness. When she mentioned the wrappings and the other attention-getting phenomena, she noticed that the psychic was staring at her intently. At one point, Chris looked at her, expecting her to comment, but Perrin said nothing, and Chris continued. "Does she walk in her sleep quite a bit?" asked Dyer. "No. No, tonight's the first time. Or at least the first time that I know of, so I guess it's this hyperactivity thing she's got, don't you think?" "Oh, I really wouldn't know," said the priest. "I've heard sleepwalking's common at puberty. Except that..." Here he shrugged and broke off. "I don't know. Guess you'd better ask your doctor." Throughout the remainder of the discussion, Mrs. Perrin sat quietly, watching the dance of flames in the living room fireplace. Equally subdued, Chris noticed, was the astronaut, who looked down into his drink with an occasional grunt meant to signify interest and attention. He was scheduled for a flight to the moon within the year. "Well, I do have that mass to say," said the dean as he rose to leave. It triggered a general departure. All stood up and expressed their thanks for dinner and the evening. At the door, Father Dyer took Chris's hand as he earnestly probed her eyes and asked, "Do you think there's a part in one of your movies for a very short priest who can play the piano?" "Well, if there isn't," Chris said, laughing, "then I'll have one written in for you, Father." Chris bade him a warm and fond good night. The last to leave were Mary Jo Perrin and her son. Chris held them at the door with idle chatter. She had the feeling that the psychic had something on her mind that she was holding back. To delay her departure, Chris asked her opinion on Reagan's continued use of the Ouija board and her Captain Howdy fixation. "Do you think there's any harm in it?" she asked. Expecting an airily perfunctory dismissal, Chris was surprised when Mrs. Perrin frowned and looked down at the doorstep. She seemed to be thinking, and still in this posture, she stepped outside and joined her son, who was waiting on the stoop. When at last she lifted her head, her eyes were in shadow. "I would take it away from her," she said quietly. She handed ignition keys to her son. "Bobby, start up the car," she told him. "It's cold." He took the keys, told Chris shyly that he loved her in all her films, and then walked away swiftly toward an old battered Mustang parked down the street. His mother's eyes were still in shadow. "I don't know what you think of me," she said quietly and slowly. "Many people associate me with spiritualism." "That's wrong." "Oh, yes, I think I have a gift," she went on. "But it isn't occult. In fact, to me it seems perfectly natural. Being a Catholic, I believe that we all have a foot in two worlds. The one that we're conscious of is in time, and now and then a freak like me gets a flash from the other foot. And that one, I think, is in eternity, where time doesn't exist, and so the future and the past are both the present. So now and again when I'm feeling a tingling in that other foot, I believe that I'm seeing the future. Though, who knows," she said, "maybe not." She shrugged. "Well, whatever. But now the occult." She paused, carefully picking her words. "The occult is something different. I've stayed away from that. I think dabbling with it can be dangerous, and that includes fooling around with a Ouija board. Until now, Chris had thought Perrin a woman of eminent good sense, and yet something in her manner now was causing Chris to feel a creeping foreboding. She tried to dispel it. "Oh, come on, Mary Jo," Chris said with a smile. "Don't you know how those Ouija board works? It's anything at all but a person's subconscious, that's all." "Yes, perhaps," Perrin answered. "Perhaps. It could all be suggestion. But in story after story that I've heard about seances, Ouija boards, all of that, Chris, they always seem to be pointing to the opening of a door of some sort. I know you don't believe in the spirit world, Chris, but I do. And if I'm right, perhaps the bridge between the two worlds is what you yourself just mentioned, the subconscious mind. All I know is that things seem to happen. And my dear, there are lunatic asylums all over the world filled with people who dabbled in the occult." "Oh, come on, you're kidding, Mary Jo. I mean, aren't you?" Silence. Then again the soft voice began droning out of the darkness. "There was a family in Bavaria in 1921. I don't remember the name, but they were a family of 11. You could check it in the newspapers, I suppose. Just a short time following an attempt at a seance, they went out of their minds. All of them. All 11. They went on a burning spree in their house, and when they'd finished with the furniture, they started on the 3-month-old baby of one of the younger daughters. And that is when the neighbors broke in and stopped them. The entire family," she ended, "was put in an asylum." "Oh, man," Chris breathed as she thought of Captain Howdy, who had now assumed a menacing coloration. "Mental illness, was that it? Something. I knew I should have taken Rags to a psychiatrist," she said. "Oh, for heaven's sake," said Mrs. Perrin, stepping forward into the light. "You never mind about me. You just listen to your doctor." There was attempted reassurance in her voice that seemed to Chris to lack conviction. "I'm great at the future," Perrin added with a smile. "But in the present, I'm absolutely helpless." She was fumbling in her purse. "Now then, where are my glasses? Ah, there, you see, I've mislaid them. Ah, here they are, right here." She had found them in a pocket of her coat. "Lovely home," she remarked as she put on the glasses and glanced up at the upper facade of the house. "Gives a feeling of warmth." "What a flipping relief," said Chris. "For a second there, I thought you were going to tell me the house is haunted." Mrs. Perrin glanced down to her, unsmiling. "Why would I tell you a thing like that?" she asked. Chris was thinking of a friend, a noted actress in Beverly Hills, who had sold her home because of her insistence that it was inhabited by a poltergeist. Grinning wanly, Chris shrugged. "I don't know," she said. "Just kidding." "It's a good, friendly house," Mrs. Perrin reassured her in an even tone. "I've been here before, you know, many times." "Oh, have you really?" "Yes, a friend of mine owned it, an admiral in the Navy. I get a letter from him now and then. They've shipped him to sea again, poor dear. I don't know if it's really him that I miss, or this house." She smiled. "But then maybe you'll invite me back." "Mary Jo, I'd love to have you back. I mean it. You're a fascinating person. Hey, listen, call me. Will you call me next week?" Yes. Yes, I would love to hear your daughter's coming on. You got the number?" "I do." "What was wrong?" wondered Chris. Something in the psychic's tone was off-center. "Well, good night," said Mrs. Perrin, "and thanks again for a marvelous evening." And before Chris could answer her, the psychic was rapidly walking down the street. Chris watched her and then slowly closed the front door as a heavy lassitude overcame her. "Quite a night," she thought. "Some night." She went to the living room and stood over Willie, who was kneeling by the urine stain. She was brushing up the nap of the rug.
"White vinegar I put on," Willie muttered. "Two times.
Coming out?"
"Maybe now. I do not know. We will see."
"No, you can't really tell until it dries." "Yeah, that's brilliant observation there, Punchy. Brilliant. Judas Priest kid. Go to bed." "Come on, leave it alone for now, Willie. Come on, get to sleep."
"No, no, I finish."
"Okay, then. And thanks, Willie. Good night."
"Good night, madam."
Chris started up the stairs with weary steps. "Great curry there, Willie," she called down. "They all loved it."
"Thank you, madam."
Chris looked in on Reagan and found her still asleep, then remembered the Ouija board. Should she hide it? Throw it away?
Boy, Perrin's really dingy when it comes to that stuff, she thought.
Yet Chris was aware that the fantasy playmate was morbid and unhealthy.
"Yeah. Yeah," she thought. "Maybe I should chuck it."
Still, she was hesitant. Standing by the bedside and looking at Reagan, she remembered an incident when her daughter was 3, the night that Howard had decided she was much too old to continue to sleep with her baby bottle on which she had grown dependent. He'd taken it away from her that night, and Reagan had screamed until 4 in the morning, then behaved hysterically for days thereafter. Chris feared a similar reaction now. "Better wait until I talk it all out with a shrink." Moreover, the Ritalin, she reflected, hadn't had a chance to take effect, so at the last, she decided to wait and see. Chris retired to her room, settled wearily into bed, and almost instantly fell asleep, then awakened to the sound of Reagan screaming,
"Mother, come here! Come here! I'm afraid!" "Oh, my baby, what's wrong?" Chris exclaimed.
She flicked on the lights.
"Good Christ almighty!"
Her face stained with tears, contorted with terror. Reagan lay taut on her back as she gripped at the sides of a narrow bed.
"Mother, why is it shaking?" she cried. "Make it stop, Mom! I'm scared! Make it stop, Mom! Make it stop!"
The bed's mattress was violently quivering back and forth.